Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Everybody in the Pool, the podcast for the climate economy. We dive deep into the climate crisis and come up with solutions. I'm Molly Wood. Let's get back to food this week. Heat domes and floods and fires affect all kinds of things, obviously, and our agriculture and food production systems are already feeling the strain. And of course, traditional large-scale farming practices are incredibly resource intensive. They contribute to soil degradation, water pollution from fertilizer runoff, high greenhouse gas emissions. And as the impacts of climate change intensify, whether extreme weather events or shifting growing seasons, we kind of need to rethink how we grow food. So on today's show, we'll take a look at one of those options, vertical farming.
Hi, Molly. Great to be here. My name is Alexander Olson. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Babylon Microfarms. We build small-scale vertical farming systems that we remotely manage to enable businesses and communities to grow their own fresh food on site.
So tell me how you got the idea for this. Like, what was the impetus to start this particular company?
Yeah, so we were students at the University of Virginia, and in the social entrepreneurship program there, we were exploring ways to feed people in refugee camps. And one of the ideas was to develop small-scale farming systems. Like, what would that look like? And so I was introduced to the wonderful world of hydroponics, which is a way of growing crops in water instead of soil, super resource efficient, so you can grow food in places where you might not otherwise be able to. And so through that research project, we were like designing concepts, open sourcing them. And, you know, for all of its merits, and that's sort of key to where we want to take Babylon, I was like, well, why aren't people doing this in the US? You know, these small-scale farms are viable. It's very different to the big commercial vertical farms, which we may talk about a little bit more later. And why aren't people building small-scale farms? I think that could make this kind of farming accessible to entirely new markets in places that actually really need it most. And so that was the insight nearly 8 years ago. And so I spent a year kind of tinkering, building prototypes in like a dorm room, and found my co-founder, and we started building together. And one thing led to another. And we started the company while we were 22 at the time, in our third year of college, and we're now 7 years in actually this month. So yeah, it's come a long way since then. But that was the initial idea.
So talk a little bit about why farming itself needed sort of a redo. And then you alluded to this idea of large scale vertical farms. I mean, so it sounds like it exists. You're innovating on farming, but also vertical farming at the same time.
Yeah, you could say that. So, you know, I think the agricultural system is broken in a lot of ways, and that's fairly well documented. But generally speaking, you know, you have these large kind of monocrop culture farming systems that are super damaging to the environment, right? From fertilizer runoff to pesticide usage, you name it, they're causing a lot of issues. And there's a general shift towards more regenerative practices and supporting local farmers and all of this stuff. And indoor farming is part of that toolkit, right? So you're able to bring farms closer to the consumer, there's less shipping, less waste, and you're able to grow with much less resources and ultimately a higher quality product for the customer. So I was pretty captivated by indoor farming as a kind of climate adaptation tool and something that could augment the existing farming system and become part of the change that's needed to get people growing food in a more sustainable way.
So was it always, let's talk about climate impact a little bit, because certainly it's a more sustainable way to grow. And also there's this adaptation component that I really want to dive into. So let's start with like how it's a more sustainable way to grow, and then we'll get to the good stuff.
Yeah, so hydroponics at high level, right? Dissolving the nutrients in water. They're typically a closed-loop system, so there's very little water is needed to grow the plant from seed to harvest. Because they're indoors, they don't really need any pesticides or any kind of harmful inputs like that. And you know, you're using the sun or, in our case, controlled lighting to grow food all year round. So there's very little transportation, and you may know that, you know, up to 60% of our fresh produce is wasted before it reaches the plate. So it's a pretty broken system that often results in just a poor quality product for the consumer, right? It's a soggy bag of spinach or lettuce that ends up, yeah, that you end up buying in the store. And so indoor product is high nutritional value, doesn't have such waste, and it has a much longer shelf life. So that's the main angle. And for indoor farming particularly, it's about kind of localizing the supply chain, increasing resilience, and, you know, providing an alternative to that wasteful supply chain that exists today that is ultimately not very sustainable.
And then one of the things that we also know about agriculture is that with increasingly severe weather as a result of climate change, we're already experiencing crop loss. And there may be real questions in the near and distant future about how to feed people. So let's talk about this as an adaptation and mitigation solution.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that drives me, right? It's like self-sufficiency, self-reliance is pretty innate to human nature. And I think as you look at the massive international and sort of coast-to-coast supply chains that exist for some of the basic kind of grocery and produce items that we take for granted, that is completely unsustainable, both from the emissions in transportation, but also from the fact that, you know, every year now we're having floods, E. coli, you name it, there are things that really disrupt the supply chain for specific items. And I think we're going to see the frequency of those disruptions increase, and with it, the need for alternatives that are more resilient. I will say that it's part of the solution. It's not the solution. There are some evangelists that say every plant, you know, all our food's going to be grown indoors. I don't necessarily agree with that. But I think for some items that are highly perishable, like leafy greens and herbs and some kind of vine crops, it is economical and it's a much higher quality product that hopefully frees up land to be used for more regenerative and sustainable practices.
Give me some more examples of the types of crops that grow well indoors and maybe some that don't.
Broadly speaking, you know, you've got all your leafy green categories, so kale, spinach, lettuces, etc., most of your major culinary herbs and vine crops from tomatoes, cucumbers through to like strawberries and blackberries, things like that. There's a lot of people growing cannabis indoors. We don't do that, but that's another option. And you know, it's technically feasible to grow any.
I wasn't going to ask you this, but I have to. Like when you were experimenting this with this in your dorm room, none of it was weed?
It was mentioned, but it was not taken off on.
Very disciplined of you.
Yeah. In Virginia, that's not allowed. Maybe in California, but. it's technically possible to grow a much broader range of crops indoors. It's just not economically feasible. And there's a lot of research done on wheat, potatoes, you know, stuff in the space station. I think they've tried some really exciting crop varieties, but it does not make economic sense at this time.
So who is the ideal customer for Babylon Farms, like, or micro farms? Who do you think should have this product?
Well, before I answer that, I think we talked about indoor farming broadly, and I think it's important to draw a differentiation between these big commercial greenhouses and plant factories that are commonly seen in the media. So you're talking like tens of thousands of square feet.
Yeah, let's dig into that because I don't think people even know that exists, actually. I just thought all the leafy greens were like in Omaha.
Right. So it's one end of the spectrum. And then what you're seeing is kind of new solutions emerging from kind of kits at the consumer level to what we do, which sits in the middle, which is sort of turnkey modular farms, and they're designed for businesses and communities. So today, our ideal customers are colleges, universities, schools, and then we do a lot of work in like senior living, healthcare, and hotels and resorts as well. So we're basically putting the farm on site adjacent to their food service operation and then growing food that is actually used on site by this location.
Okay, so go back to the huge commercial greenhouses and indoor farming. So on the one, it feels like it's useful here to sort of break down the agricultural spectrum, because on the one hand, you have cropland, which we know is, like you said, there's monocrop issues, there's overuse of pesticides. Then there's this kind of universe of commercial scale indoor and greenhouse agriculture. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. It's just a different tool in the toolkit, right? So if you think of indoor farming as an umbrella term that encompasses all these different ways of growing food indoors, and each of those tools is better suited to different environments, right?
Got it.
So an indoor vertical farm might make sense in a colder climate where you have less sunlight, more, you know, extreme seasons, whereas a greenhouse, which benefits from natural sunlight and, you know, those may be better in more temperate climates, just as an example. And then for us, it's like, what if we put farms like immediately on site so you're not buying it in? We just did the world's first cruise ship. So they have a vertical farm on a cruise ship. You know, that's a great example where like...
That's so smart.
Thanks. There was no option for them. So like, you know, while Our approach is very different to a lot of others in the industry. There are use cases like that where it's like glaringly obvious why it makes sense. It's like, well, they literally couldn't grow food and now they have Vertical Farm on board their ship and they're growing food.
Yeah.
You know, that is an outlier. It's not a big market for us, but I think it's a really good use case.
I mean, I would imagine there must be things like that that you just would not have thought of. I mean, So it's a market segmentation question fundamentally. And then your value proposition for a college campus or a senior living facility or a cruise ship is you can have this fresh food that you might not otherwise be able to get economically or sustainably and just have access to it all the time.
Yeah, so it's twofold. You know, for us as a company, we want to drive the cost of these systems down to make it economically viable to grow a host of varieties on site. So you're not shipping them in, you have year-round availability, et cetera. But for a lot of our clients, like we capture some of the soft and like socially beneficial impacts of farming in a way that is completely lost on other large-scale farms. So when you put a farm in the heart of the cafeteria, in the lobby of a senior living home, that is a focal point for the community. They're able to not only use the food on site, but they're actually building experiences that can help educate and inspire people to eat healthier diets. They can be used for different programming. We actually just launched a product this week called the STEM Garden, which is a pun. And it is used for STEM education, right? So we're literally putting these in classrooms to teach kids about a wide range of subjects using the farms as a tool. So I think that's where like our value goes beyond just growing fresh food. It is about what does it mean to actually grow food on site and how can you kind of captivate the imaginations of the communities that maybe weren't exposed to growing food in their normal lives.
Yeah. And then you mentioned I'm starting to get all these Instagram ads. I assume it's as a result of our email correspondence because that level of stalking. But I'm getting a bunch of Instagram ads lately for consumer level kind of indoor farms. Like, I wonder how you think about this sort of decentralization of food production broadly.
Yeah, I think it fits into a broader shift. If you look at like the patterns towards self-sufficiency, sustainability, you know, circular buildings and communities of the future, you're going to have renewables on site. You're going to have vertical farms or indoor farms on site. And that's providing some or all of your energy produce needs. You're going to be able to harvest water from the air. You know, these are all tools that typically are decentralized because they're part of the value is bringing the generation of whatever that is, power, food, water to the point of consumption. And that allows you to kind of control your own destiny.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, more on how micro farms work and whether you can get one at home.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Everybody in the Pool. We're talking with Alexander Olson of Babylon Microfarms about growing food in a whole new way. How do the microfarms work? Because they're pretty high tech. It's not just like you don't have to have a green thumb. Seems to be a big value proposition of the ones on Instagram and also Babylon Microfarms.
Yeah. So for, for comparison, there's a lot of technology and innovation that goes into these big scale vertical farms. And so when you go into them, they're often highly automated. They have a host of sensors and cameras and whatnot that are helping to run the farm with fewer people. And so we looked at that and basically sought to miniaturize a lot of those features. So we dose nutrients, we control the pH, we control the irrigation, lighting, etc., so that you don't have to. And then we did miniaturize that kind of technology and we designed it so we can run it remotely. So we actually have a team here that are, we joke about it being like air traffic control. They're basically kind of watching these plants grow, controlling the variables and can actually kind of remotely manage someone's farm for them. And that's making it a lot easier for people to start growing their own food, right? So for most of our farmers and customers, they are not farmers and have never grown food before. But because we're remotely managing it and supporting them, we're able to kind of control the science behind it so that all they're doing is planting, harvesting, and cleaning.
How did you learn all this? It must have been a long process of development.
plenty of mistakes along the way, a lot of trial and error. But I think between me and my co-founder, we're both very passionate about developing hardware, technology, and the underlying hydroponics. So we've learned a lot over the last 7 years, and I think as a company, we're really trying just this continuous improvement and encouraging everyone to kind of learn and study what we're doing and things like it, so that we can continually stay on the front foot.
Can you describe sort of the installation for us? What is it, like to have one of these farms in a facility?
Yeah, so we're B2B today, so we work with different corporate clients from major food service companies down to like nonprofits at a community level. They'd order a farm, we ship it to them on a pallet. The installation process takes a couple of hours, and our farms today are plumbed into a water line, so you hook it up, plug it in, and then once it's filled with water, it will take over, and you basically scan seed pods into the farm. So we have a QR code system that enables the farm to register what crops are being put in the farm. We then administer a recipe, we can alert people what to do, when to harvest, etc., and then they are growing. And so depending on their use case, we'll set them up on a schedule so they could be harvesting every week or every month a set amount. And that way, the farms are looking green and that they're able to kind of have this year-round gardening experience on site.
And then how do you think of this still, like you mentioned that you're sort of one of your initial impeti was feeding refugees. Like how do you see this as an equity issue also? I sort of feel like, community gardens are in that category of things that can help alleviate food deserts.
Yeah, I think at least in the US, we see ourselves as a tool often implemented adjacent to other kind of local sourcing initiatives. So whether that's food, whether it's supporting local farmers, encouraging nutritional education, putting farms in food deserts, we've seen a wide range of programs and we love to support all of them. And the farms are a great way to do that. In a lot of cases, our clients might be building an outdoor farm or raised beds, community garden, but that's only good for certain months of the year. And then they have the indoor farms as the kind of year-round alternative. So, we're really just part of that equation. And, as we scale up, we're still in relatively low volume production, but the path to drive these units down in cost to the point where they could be a economical food source for people, it's pretty clear, as in we need to scale up significantly from where we are today to achieve that. But that's the path we're on and why we got into this is like, okay, really they're plastic and metal and glass and they could cost a lot less at the right volume. So let's just figure out how to find markets where we can be successful, use that to scale up production. And we have a couple of announcements coming later this year about some products that will drastically cut the cost. And, that's like our engineering team. That's all they're working on is how to design them to be manufactured more easily and more affordably so that we can make it more accessible.
Yep. And then let's talk a little more about adaptation and resilience. I just want to double click on, you mentioned like you don't think it's feasible to decentralize completely. There's still going to have to be agriculture.
What, I guess, would you want to decentralize completely? I think it's like...
Seems very subsistence and scary. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I'm just thinking about how fun it would be to have someone like only live off micro farms, but we haven't done that yet. But it is, I think it's part of the solution. There are certain things as you look at like, basically we should move to more regenerative practices, and that will involve growing things that are suited to the season and the locality that they're grown in. And that actually will limit the ability to kind of import stuff. And so that's where microfarms can come in, right? You could grow lettuces, herbs, some of these crops that may be more sensitive all year round on site. And that frees up the land to hopefully be used for more kind of local and regenerative practices. As you look at kind of like mega cities of the future that are happening now, like I think having greenhouses and vertical farms within the city limits is a super powerful tool, and it's going to be very necessary. And I think you see, I believe it's Singapore has like a 30% self-sufficiency goal for food production by 2030, which is super ambitious. And they, to my knowledge, don't have much arable land, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that. It's a sensible thing for city planners and countries to do, just to be less reliant on long international supply chains.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a sense that that's a pretty large scale movement, or is it sort of here and there? Like it's like Singapore and Ann Arbor and, I made that up about Ann Arbor. They're just very climate forward, it seems like.
It's got to start somewhere. But I think if you're, thinking about the future of the country in an uncertain climate, whichever country you're in, localizing your food supply chain and being more in control of that is a national security issue in a lot of ways. So I see that referenced from time to time. And I think some countries are more proactive than others, like the Netherlands. You know, they've been, you know, I think they're the second biggest exporter of food in the world. And they're one of the smallest countries in the world just because all of it's grown indoors. So I think there are clear case studies where indoor farms can be used as a really vibrant industry that, you know, helps them be more self-sufficient and is just a great industry for job creation and you know, supports their economy.
What can you tell us about the kind of percentages of indoor farming to sort of more traditional agriculture? Like, do you have
I think in the U.S., I have one stat for leafy green production. I think it's less than 1% of leafy green production is grown indoors.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's still tiny.
That seems, you know, like even a really, is a, yeah, is exactly. A, that seems
emerging, exciting industry. I think it is still a tiny, tiny percentage of overall production. And you know, the forecasts are that that's going to increase significantly over the next coming years. And I think that's sort of the pattern that is generally seen in the industry, which doesn't apply to us so much in the microfarming business, is that certain crop types become economically viable to be grown indoors. And if the alternative is shipping them thousands of miles from across the country or across the world, you're going to see some of that production move locally if it's economically viable to do so. So,
right.
You know, it's part of a broader shift that's happening in agriculture, and it's going to affect specific kind of crop varieties more than others.
What makes it more or less economically viable? I mean, obviously, it's like you have to build buildings to grow crops in. There's an energy question, energy use question. How do the economics work out? Yeah.
Yeah, there are a couple of big drivers for the industry. So LED lighting was the big one that's happened over the last decade, where the cost of LED lighting has fallen drastically and it's got a lot more efficient. And as a result, indoor farms and greenhouses with supplemental lighting have become much more energy efficient. And therefore, you know, as those costs have fallen, the crops like leafy greens and herbs have become viable. So, you know, I think it's a stepping stone. The next wave, there are kind of two big next waves that people talk about. I think there are varying degrees of success in actually implementing them. But crop genetics, there are a lot of opportunities to grow new crop varieties indoors that maybe aren't served by the traditional supply chain. Things that grow, they're smaller, they're more compact, they grow quicker. These are things that could give indoor farms an advantage. And then the other one is AI, which kind of complements that, right? Can you create growth recipes with the lights and the nutrients to kind of supercharge growth and get more productivity out of the farms? I think both of those areas have a lot of promise that will drive the industry forward in the future.
That's fascinating. And then just for people who are not familiar, you know, this is a topic that I am really trying to spend some time on this season of Everybody in the Pool. But people, I think, are not 100, like, we have a sense that agriculture is broken. We're not quite sure how much. Like, can you just sort of just, you went by that like, yeah, everybody knows it's broken. But I would love for you to dig into some of the ways that it's broken and really, you know, harmful from a climate perspective.
I'm forgetting my stats off the top of my head, but I think it's something like 70% of fresh water is used on agriculture, and it's responsible for about 25% of our carbon emissions. And that doesn't include, you know, the loss of soil, like soil degradation, fertilizer runoff that like poisons our oceans and our water. There are a lot of layers to it. And I think that's one of the issues with it's quite hard to quantify.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you talk to people in our industry and others, like it's pretty scary what's happening in a lot of areas of the world where you're just pumping them full of fertilizer, you're bleaching the soil with pesticides. And there is a kind of tipping point that a lot of people think we're passing in various areas of the world where, you know, the ecosystem of bugs and things that live off, that were living off the soil, start to collapse. And then at that point, you face kind of a more existential crisis around, can we actually grow any food? You know, I think we're not there yet, but I think the need to change how we grow food and to be more sustainable and support kind of biodiversity is very present. And I think beginning to be more well understood.
I also only recently became aware of how nitrogen-based fertilizer is like massively energy intensive to create, which I didn't totally know. So does indoor farming alleviate some of the need for fertilizer and pesticides, I would imagine?
Yeah. So, you know, indoor farming is an interesting one because it uses energy, right? So if, right, you know, the energy is sourced renewably, then it can be much more sustainable across the board. But yeah, we still use fertilizer. In most cases, there are no pesticides. That's a big advantage. And then crucially, you're almost eliminating the transportation and handling that comes with the produce. So there are lots of steps to it, but it is ultimately a lot more resource efficient than shipping it across the world and growing it where you're dumping fertilizer and pesticides on it.
Right. All right. So what is your ultimate dream for Babylon Microfarms? Like where, you know, if you were like, I want one of these, no question, in all of these places, what does that look like?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the long run, we see that like every organization is going to have their own indoor farm growing some or all of their food on site. And you know, in the near term, we want to see a farm in every school. I think there's so many clear benefits to growing food on site for, you know, emotional health and well-being, as well as the STEM education subjects. That's kind of our near-term focus. But as a company, we built the software platform to run these farms remotely. That's pretty robust. And now we're developing different hardware systems to grow different crop types and also to serve different markets that all run off that software. So we've always been running our own race a little bit in the industry. Like that approach is fairly different. We're seeing that it's enabling organizations and communities to grow their own food in a way that maybe doesn't make sense for them to go and build a greenhouse or build a big farm, but they can just roll one of these modular systems in and start growing, you know, within a few days. And that there's actually a pretty big market for that, as we're finding.
And then how much does the system cost? Jen, what's the ballpark?
So our first system, that our kind of flagship model, the gallery, is $15,000. It's about the size of a double door refrigerator. And then there's a sort of service and subscription fee with that. And then we just launched this week our STEM garden product, which is $6,500. So it's already a big step down. It is a little bit of a smaller footprint unit, but that's kind of the kind of cost reduction we like to see. And in the future, we're kind of hoping to keep driving these costs down so it can be similar price to your everyday kind of household appliance.
This is fantastic. Where can people find you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, Alexander Olson, and then check out our website, BabylonMicrofarms.com.
Alexander, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Molly.
Vertical farming is still a tiny fraction of overall agricultural production, but, you know, what's not to like about locally grown, resource-efficient food? I'm going to shop for one of those countertop dealies to grow some leafy greens and herbs. And that's it for this episode of Everybody in the Pool. Thank you so much for listening. Email me your thoughts and suggestions to everybodyinthepool.com, and you can find all the latest episodes and the newsletter at everybodyinthepool.com, the website. If you want to become a subscriber and get an ad-free version of the show and support my work directly, hit the link in the description in your podcast app of choice. Thanks to those of you who already have. Together, we can get this done. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.